Our last case this morning is 12-999, the Columbus Bar Association versus Stanley Earl Culbreth. For the respondent, is it Mr. Donchance?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Ken Donchatz and I represent Stanley Culbreth, the respondent in this case. This is a case where the facts, the court's precedent, and public policy do not support the recommended penalty. In fact, at the hearing, the relator even argued for a lesser penalty. And then everyone, I think, was caught off guard by the recommendation that came from the board, which was permanent disbarment. The main issue I want to argue with you today is the same issue that you just heard, basically, which is how do we weigh the mitigation evidence of mental illness in light of the misconduct? In this case, we had two medical professionals testify on behalf of Mr. Culbreth. One was from OLAP, and the other was his treater, a licensed social worker. And they established all three elements of Rule 10G, and they talked about, unlike the last case, how Mr. Culbreth's problems are not chronic mental illness problems. They are illnesses that arose, conditions that arose, because of the events that all happened in 2007, which you saw both in the record and in my objections, the death of a longtime law partner, the sudden death of a brother, the loss of a longtime secretary, coupled with events in his son's life where his son failed out of OU, was arrested for drug trafficking, and was incarcerated for that. This caused his wife to relapse into alcoholism. And what we have to look at is what happened to Mr. Culbreth in that really discreet 13-month period. He was, for the first time in his career, responsible for the accounting in his law office. Not responsible as in all lawyers are responsible for maintaining their trust account and not, you know, stealing or losing their client's money, but he was actually now responsible for the day-to-day operation of that where he had never been before. Coupled with that, he was responsible for taking over Paul Brown's clients. Because of the sudden death of Mr. Brown, he had a full docket. Those clients couldn't be lost. Their cases couldn't fall through the cracks. But then he loses his brother, his CPA, and he loses his longtime secretary. In addition to those things that were happening in his office, he was forced to deal with things at home that he never had to deal with before, such as his son losing his scholarships and going to prison, such as his wife falling into alcoholism, and then you see from the record that she got into his trust account. What the medical professionals testified to was this caused depression, adjustment disorder, grief disorder, and other illnesses related to depression. We established causation through their testimony. They did testify to within a degree of medical certainty. They testified as to probability, not possibility. And they both testified that with proper treatment, they were confident that Mr. Culbreth could reemerge into the practice of law with certain conditions. They recommended monitoring. They recommended continued education in law office management. So in a case like this where we have that kind of mitigation, it should be weighed against the conduct. The case I cited for you in the objections that I would like you to consider because I think it most closely resembles this case is the Hopple case that you decided, I believe, last term. It was a 2011 case. That was a commingling case, just like this case. Here, though, unlike Mr. Hopple, Mr. Culbreth admitted to the commingling. He stipulated to it before the hearing. He didn't make the relator prove the commingling. Mr. Hopple had 30 incidences where grievance came forward, where violations were found. Mr. Culbreth only had two. Mr. Hopple had to make restitution. He had misappropriated money. Here, Mr. Culbreth did not misappropriate money. There is no evidence that he ever misappropriated money. His problem here is that he didn't manage the money. He didn't balance his checkbook. He didn't keep records. So you
Wasn't there some commingling with IOLTA?
There was commingling of his personal funds with, yes. Yes,
okay,
Your Honor,
so that's not just, you know, a failure of not being able to reconcile your checking account. You're not allowed to do that.
You're not allowed to do that, and he admitted to that, and he took responsibility for that, and he said on the record, I know I'm not allowed to do this. But the comparison to Hopple is that in Hopple there was client money missing, and Hopple was forced to make restitution. Here, Mr. Culbreth commingled, but there was never anyone who came forward and said, my money is missing. There was never any proof at the hearing that there was money missing. There's no clear and convincing evidence that any money was missing. And even now, to this day, no one has come forward and said, hey, my money is missing. So that is a big distinction between Hopple. The point is that in Hopple, with facts that are tremendously more difficult than this one, more egregious, Mr. Hopple was given the benefit of an indefinite suspension, and he was told that he could go through rehabilitative activities for his mental illnesses, and then he could come back to the practice with conditions. And I am here to argue to you today that that same result should inure to Mr. Culbreth. And I think what you're asked to do today is to really examine how it is that the profession wants to deal with an attorney who suffers the kind of losses that Mr. Culbreth suffered. Do we want to tell him, we understand that your partner of 20 years died suddenly and that you were forced to deal with his practice? We understand that your brother died. We understand that all these things happened to your wife and your son and that you were overwhelmed and that you called the Bar Association for help and all you were told was go and get a mentor. Do we want to tell him that in those circumstances, when he is working so hard for all these other people, that he can't even grieve, that he can't even take care of himself, which is what the testimony was from the medical professionals, do we want to tell him that that's it, end of game, we aren't going to help you, we're going to tell you that you are disbarred and that's the end of it? Or do we want to tell him, we see what happened, we understand what happened, thank God it wasn't worse, but you need to take some time off. You need to work with your treater. You need to work with your doctors. You need to work with OLAP. And when you're ready, and you can prove to us that you're ready, we'll let you come back, and you continue to do all of the good work you've done for 38 years that you were recognized for volunteering for the NAACP, and the United Negro College Fund, and all of the contributions that this man has made over the years to our profession.
Was Mr. Culbreth in a two-man practice?
I'm sorry, sir.
Was Mr. Culbreth in a two-man law firm?
Yes, he was.
What's the status of that law firm today?
It was changed to a sole practitioner, LLC, and he is winding it down.
He's still practicing today?
He is, but he's winding it down, yes.
And what does that mean exactly, winding it down?
I think he understands what's happening here, and he knows that he's got to get someone to come in to take over his practice based on what you decide. So he is in the process of that transition right now.
Counsel, the panel seemed to suggest that there was no responsibility being taken for this misconduct, and they referred to the previous misconduct as well. When was that?
That was over 10 years ago. That was in the 90s, I believe, and that was...
Was it similar activity?
No, ma'am. That was an issue where he let a law clerk conduct an opening statement, I believe. So he was charged with participating in a UPL. As to the first issue you raised of taking responsibility for this action, well, I have to disagree with the panel there to some extent. He stipulated to the commingling. You know, he went and he got an attorney to represent him. I know that there is a huge documents issue here, and I'm sure the relator is going to talk about it, but when you have a commingling case and you have an attorney who hasn't kept up with their responsibilities to balance their checkbook and keep all the paperwork and the closing statements and all of that, the easiest thing in the world to do if you're a prosecutor is just to continue asking for documents, because you know the other side doesn't have them. They've admitted up front they don't have them. So that's what the largest bulk of the hearing was about, is this document chase. But
well, when reviewing the report, apparently there was some treatment that was being had with a mental health professional and a physician who refused to testify at this hearing.
Yes, Dr. Tarpey.
And then there was also your client's continued drug use that was an issue in
yes.
the whole picture here, that he's been using marijuana recreationally since the age of 23. Is that correct?
That was one piece of the testimony. There were three different testimonies about that drug use. That was one.
Yeah,
of them,
I mean, they were pretty much inconsistent, and
right.
I don't believe the panel believed that he was no longer using marijuana on a regular basis.
I would agree that that's what the panel believes.
That is
what they seem to say in their opinion.
So,
yes.
You know, some of this behavior has certainly predated the problems that you've brought to our attention that may have caused him some situational stress that he's experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, this was long before that was that happened. The death and the loss of the secretary, et cetera.
Right. Well, may I address both points? First, with the marijuana issue, that was brought up by Judge Whitmore. She asked Judith Fisher, the medical witness, about that. And Judith Fisher basically said, look, you know, this is depression. People try to make themselves feel better. I want to know whether that's actually what he was doing with that. He's not been diagnosed with addiction. Even OLAP said this is just abuse. It is not addiction. They never went so far as to say more about that. But Stephanie Kuznarek,
it was an addiction problem. You know, you'd have a whole different defense here. You know, there's actually, in my view, someone who is, you know, recreationally involved in this sort of thing is doing it willfully, and you know, that's a big problem, as opposed, and so too is an addiction, of course, but that to me is a concern, and as well as the less than stellar assessment from OLAP on his compliance and his ability to follow through on the contract with OLAP.
Well, I don't know that they ever said in testimony that Stephanie Kuznarek ever said that he wasn't following through. I think what she said was his level of compliance was satisfactory, which is a word that means a million different things, but she never said he was out of compliance or that he had breached the contract. She just said it was satisfactory.
He had done moderately well in his compliance
right.
with his recovery.
Mm-hmm.
Not exactly a ringing endorsement is what I'm reading here.
That's what the panel said, yes. Moderately well, in her terms, meant that he wasn't far enough along in for her to say more, that he had only been in there for a year. It wasn't a case where someone had been there 5 years or
well,
3 years.
Well, you have to understand that we don't usually have five-year testimony from OLAP
sure.
to come in. It is a year's contract. I mean, it is a year because of the time they contract with OLAP, and then the recommendation as to how well they're doing, and we certainly have had glowing recommendations from OLAP about the level of compliance and the progress that's being made. So
I understand.
If we don't have if the panel doesn't hear a very positive from OLAP, that is a problem.
I understand. I think what was happening there was OLAP wanted him to go into a treatment program at Talbot Hall that Talbot Hall no longer offered, and that they were having trouble finding it elsewhere in the city and had just located a program in Worthington for him to attend. But by time that second set of hearing dates came up, that program hadn't started yet. That was part of the problem OLAP had. But I think that's beyond anyone's control that Talbot Hall decided after all these years to get rid of that program. That was the standard place OLAP sent everyone, was Talbot Hall, for that kind of counseling. So that played into it as well. But what you don't have is clear and convincing evidence that he is addicted or regularly abusing marijuana. Nobody said that. What we have is inconsistent testimony about his frequency of use, but then we have some testimony from his treater saying, I think what he's trying to do is treat his depression with this. As for events that occurred before 2007, there is no testimony, no evidence at all that anything was amiss before 2007, and I would like to reserve my last 30 seconds for rebuttal, if I might.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Tyak.
Thank you, Chief Justice, esteemed members of the court. Good morning. My name is James Tyak. I'm here on behalf of the Columbus Bar Association. There are several issues to address here, but the first is that by Mr. Culber's own testimony, his misconduct did begin years and years before the year 2007. I'm going to come back to the marijuana use, but Mr. Culber's own testimony stated that he had, since the beginning of his career, understood the golden rule of not commingling funds and had, in fact, done just that. This is on page 434 through 453 of the transcript. As it relates to starting where we finished there, there are several different versions of the testimony regarding the marijuana use of Mr. Culberth, a couple of different ones from Mr. Culberth himself. The one that was probably most effective, or had most effect on the panel, was that of the OLAP, Ms. Kuznarich. She described regular use, and ultimately that was a part of why OLAP had the plan they did for Mr. Culberth, which included active treatment. Mr. Culberth did not disclose the marijuana use to Ms. Fisher, or if she did, I believe her testimony was she wasn't even sure, but that it was a decade or so ago in California. Moving right to part of his compliance with OLAP is the court is well aware from the transcripts and the record in this case that there was approximately 8 months between the two dates of hearing. Part of the reason the panel allowed Mr. Culberth to come back was to allow him literally to establish a new relationship with Ms. Fisher, who at that point in time he had not met. She was not able to make much of Dr. Tarpey's notes in the history of Mr. Culberth's treatment at the recommendation of OLAP through that time. And ultimately, I think the panel held that had very little weight at all as it relates to mitigation.
At the hearing, I believe you recommended an indefinite suspension, correct?
That is correct.
And they argued for something considerably less. Why are you supporting now a disbarment when that was, after all this testimony came out, all this evidence that you're talking about, everything was presented, and you had still an indefinite recommendation? Why would you go to the disbarment now?
I think ultimately, Your Honor, it has to do with Mr. Culberth's behavior and evasiveness at the hearing itself. Ultimately, the panel does a better job than I am going to do today describing the interaction with the panel directly and with us as counsel for the Bar Association. The reality is that of the 600-plus pages of transcripts available as a part of this record between the deposition and the hearing itself, literally a couple hundred of those pages are Mr. Culberth's testimony. The panel described it as oftentimes illogical, and I think at another occasion they questioned his truthfulness as it relates to question to them, or answers to the panel. The one that sticks out to me, Your Honor, is when he described himself, his prior disciplinary history, which was completely inaccurate. The prior dealt with, as Mr. Dunschatz stated, a legal intern who was no legal intern at all. His testimony to the panel was that he had a certificate. This court's decision made very clear he never had such a certificate. There was differences between Mr. Culberth's testimony from one day of the hearing to the next date of the hearing. Ultimately, I believe the panel felt that Mr. Culberth was trying to deceive them as it related to his prior history, let alone several other pieces here. As it relates to the mental health mitigation, obviously it is Mr. Culberth's burden, and we believe and agree with the panel that he failed in this regard. The panel tells this court that they're not convinced that the depression and anxiety contributed to the misconduct in this case. There are several parts to this, to the four prongs of whether or not mental health is a true mitigating factor in a case like this. I believe that one of them for the panel was that they didn't believe that this was an opinion by a qualified health care professional in this sense. Ms. Fisher is clearly a qualified licensed social worker. But that's not the issue. But they, I believe, thought that they didn't have a history that was necessary for her to make these decisions and ultimately these diagnoses and this testimony. She was not fully informed. She did not know about what we OLAP would have described as a problematic marijuana use, if not an addiction. She did not know about the prior disciplinary history at all. And she also recommended that Mr. Colberth follow up regarding ADD and ADHD. During these 8 months, between the time that the panel resolved the first portion of the hearing and came back for the second, no testing or follow-up was done regarding that ADD or ADHD. As you stand here today, I don't know that it ever has. The second is that ultimately, whether or not this anxiety and depression, which certainly objectively we can all appreciate with all the things that happened to Mr. Colberth, he had. However, did they contribute to this conduct in these situations? The reality is that he never followed this rule properly. By his own testimony, again, the panel member asked him a very direct question whether or not he did before, and he said, yes, to be truthful, Your Honor, I did do that before. In other words, keeping personal funds commingled.
Is there any evidence that he misappropriated funds, or
no.
Is it more record-keeping issues?
No. Part of the problem, as his counsel points out, is that the lack of records in this case is a problem in many ways. We were trying to do sort of a backwards forensic accounting of were there other people that were injured in there, in part due to an utter lack of records on the IOLTA and the other trust accounts. We're not able to find anybody, and my understanding is that there have not been any complaints coming forward saying that they have lost money that they were owed. The reality is that the prognosis from a qualified healthcare person, in this case Ms. Fisher, did talk about with certain conditions he may be able to return to practice in a meaningful way. It, I think, shines through clearly from the panel's opinion that they're not confident that's ever going to happen, regardless of what he does to fix this problem, in part because of his evasiveness during the hearing, in part because of his longstanding history in terms of not only commingling funds, marijuana use, and also, I think, a very important part for the panel was not only his prior discipline, but his lack of reality when it came to even describing that prior history. It was not a dealing with the UPL case. There's a portion of that decision where I believe in a dissent by Justice Cook, she basically had a problem with staying the suspension, because they affirmatively held that he had deceived the UPL board of the Columbus Bar Association, and she thought that he ought to have a timeout then. Your Honors, as it relates to these types of cases, clearly an indefinite suspension would be appropriate. The panel asked for something more. They talk about the Wise case. There's some other citations in our briefs. And we believe, the Columbus Bar Association, that clearly Mr. Colberth deserves at least an indefinite suspension. We don't disagree with the panel. We don't think that the panel is being too harsh, again, in large part because of his behavior in the hearing and ultimately his inability to come to terms with what he has done apparently throughout his entire career, which is commingle funds. Because there is not that smoking gun of misappropriation, it is not the case where he's dealing with restitution and stolen funds. However, it is a case where on a long-term career, 37 years, it doesn't appear he's ever done it properly. This court obviously regularly says that a case like this warrants a substantial sanction even when there is not a specific harm to a client. One of the issues that the panel points out that we don't necessarily agree with is that there was no harm to any clients. Lisa Scott testified that she did not receive her PI disbursement in those funds until there was a grievance filed. Although she's not a part of the counts of this case, her testimony was stipulated to be admissible for the court's consideration. The other is that Ms. Hassan herself, the medical bills were not covered and paid for over 14 months. Again, part of the fact here is Mr. Colbert didn't have the records to even know they were still owed money. It came to his attention through the grievance filed by a medical provider trying to collect on bills.
Mr. Tyak, your argument suggests that there may be more to this case than just is confined here, and it's more widespread. Are there other clients who are also complaining, to your knowledge?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. And I apologize. I don't want to mislead this court to think that we have evidence of other misappropriations. We do not at this time. I want to be clear on that.
Thank you.
The report suggests that the IOLTA account was used to shield assets from creditors. Is there evidence of that in the record?
There are some foreclosure actions and some other judgments against Mr. Colberth. Mr. Colbert's testimony has been consistent throughout that he commingled personal funds, in essence, by not withdrawing his fees at an appropriate time. Further, he actually brought his mother's estate funds directly into his IOLTA account and did other things. The commingling was extensive. There are literally hundreds of thousands of dollars over just these couple of years. His wife had access to the account. His wife wrote herself checks from the account.
His wife had access to his IOLTA account?
Yes, ma'am. Your Honors, in a situation like this, obviously, although we would argue there was not the worst form of harm to clients, there was at least some harm to clients. We also think that the fact of the matter is he's twice now disgraced our profession. We think that, as the panel observed, Mr. Colberth is not now able, nor will he ever be able to practice in a way that we feel the public is truly safe. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Durchance, you've saved about a half a minute.
First, his wife did not have access to his IOLTA account. She gained access after the events that I described earlier and on two occasions wrote checks. The medical professional...
How did she gain access?
She went to his office and wrote checks to herself, unfortunately. The medical professionals also testified that there was no malicious intent here, and I would put to you that the indefinite suspension would serve your purposes of protecting the public while giving him the ability to rehabilitate and, if you decide he can, come back to the practice of the law. That is the appropriate penalty here.
And right now you said he's winding down his practice?
Well, he knows that the outcome of this case, one way or another, is going to force him to have someone take over his practice, so we're working on that right now. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision.